The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
In that we have read responsively from Psalm 48 and sung through it now several times, I will not read it again as I had planned. Bruce Waltke, in a recent article that's soon to be published on the titles of the Psalms, wonders whether certain titles may not actually be the postscript for the previous psalm rather than the superscript to the psalm to which they have been traditionally attached. As we have just finished reading Psalm 48 responsively, we've sung it now several times, you may well be wondering, what is the connection between my title, A Song for My Brothers and Sisters, and Psalm 48? Surely there's been a misprint in our chapel title talks. Possibly this was just the title for another someone's chapel talk. Well, let me confirm indeed that this is the title for this chapel talk. Now, I wouldn't be alone if I were to be misleading with my title. Umberto Eco, internationally renowned author, in his volume Postscript to the Name of the Rose, suggests that titles indeed are meant to mislead, misdirect, rather than help the reader interpret a story. And if you've read his novel, The Name of the Rose, you can be sure that no one knows what that title means. But I'm not playing Echo's game with you here this morning. My title does connect and will lead us to the point in the end. But if at that point, when I finish, you're not sure of the connection of my title and the psalm, it stretches your credulity, you can console yourself that I was never Dr. Fuller's student and never had the opportunity to learn what he cautions his class about preaching fantastic sermons. So it is my weakness not to have studied with him. A song, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Now, taking Dr. Waltke's point more seriously, assuming that the superscript of the next psalm is really the postscript for this psalm, we're still in luck, because the following psalm is also a psalm of the sons of Korah. Now, I've read through the psalms many times, and I haven't always taken the time to sit down and reflect on what connections there may be between psalms of by the same psalmist. 11 psalms are attributed to the sons of Korah. They're gatekeepers in the temple precincts, according to the chronicler. The sons of Korah have brought us such exaltation, such bursts of praise as these. Psalm 42, as the deer pants for the streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. Or Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way, the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, its waters roar and foam, the mountains quake with their surging. Psalm 47, clap your hands, all you nations, shout to God with cries of joy. He is awesome, the Lord Most High, the great King over all the earth. He subdued nations under us. Or Psalm 48, one of my favorites. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Even the sparrow has found a home, the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar, O Lord Almighty. Better is a day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. Or Psalm 87, finally. He has set his foundation on the holy mountain. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are said of you, O city of God. I will record Rahab and Babylon among those who acknowledge me, Philistia too, and Tyre, along with Cush. They will say, this one was born in Zion. Indeed of Zion it will be said, this one and that one were born in her, and the Most High himself will establish her. The Lord will write in the register of the peoples, this one was born in Zion. We see the heart of the sons of Korah here, centering on the city of Zion, on the great king who dwells there. They were close to the temple, and it's reflected in their praise and in their longing, because the temple was that place where the Lord was present. They rejoiced in Psalm 84 that even the sparrow God included close to his presence. In this song, we hear them sing, great is the Lord, and the one most worthy of praise in the city of our God, his holy mountain. The Lord is indeed great there. Moreover, he is the one to be exceedingly praised. And where? The only imaginable place, precisely in his city, on his mountain, his dwelling place. It is beautiful in its loftiness, the joy of the whole earth. Like the utmost heights of Zaphon is Mount Zion, the city of the great king. Yes, it's beautiful in its loftiness, yet it is far from the tallest peak, even in its own vicinity. Mount Zion is no physical match to the mythical Zaphon, the highest of the mountains, the home of the Canaanite god Baal. Though not the tallest nor even the grandest in appearance, Zion alone in all the earth is the home of the great king, the true king, the one who is king over all the earth, the one who is the Lord, who is God. Besides him, there is no other. His presence there makes this mountain lofty, makes it the joy of the whole earth. His habitation graces Zion with a beauty that is his own. In verse 3, we hear, God is in her citadels. He has shown himself to be her fortress. Fortress, refuge, stronghold, rock, shield, comforting, powerful images, foundations upon which so many psalms are built. Not only does God inhabit her citadels, but he is her very fortress. God's presence makes her unassailable for the psalmist. Our refuge, sing the sons of Korah in the sister Psalm 46, our refuge in whom we trust, even though the entire world should fall into the heart of the sea. God is within her. She will not fail. It is no surprise, then, that in the face of attack on the city, we hear the psalmist sing this. When the kings joined forces, they advanced together. They saw her. They were astounded. They fled in terror. Trembling seized them there, pain like that of a woman in labor. You destroyed them like ships of Tarshish shattered by an east wind. Though beautiful, she is not weak. Those who would lay siege cannot do it because God defends her. Mount Zaphon is impregnable because of her extreme height. Zion, though not nearly as lofty, has a sure defense in the presence of her great king. The one with whom the inhabitants of Zion live with daily sends the kings in terrified fright. And so the psalmist exults in verse 8, as we have heard, as we have seen, in the city of the Lord Almighty, in the city of our God, God makes her secure forever. Selah. Both the inhabitants of Zion and her enemies have beheld the same sight, have beheld the self-same one, but the response could not have been more different. For the citizens of Zion, there is wonder at what they have seen, God present, majestic, holy, to defend and to keep his people, his city. The nations, rather than streaming to the mount of God, as Isaiah speaks about in another day, turn tail and flee at the sight of this great God. To make Zion secure forever, that is to establish her in Hebrew, the identical language used in Psalm 87. where the sons of Korah sing of that day when God will include the nations, not sending them away, but making them inhabitants of the city that he will establish forever. Isaiah adds to this song a challenge to us, calling the watchmen on Jerusalem's wall to disturb God until he establishes Zion and makes her the praise of the earth. Verse 9, within your temple, O God, we meditate on your unfailing love. Like your name, O God, your praise reaches to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is filled with righteousness. Mount Zion rejoices. The villages of Judah are glad because of your judgments. To the temple, many a psalmist has repaired for his praise and meditation. It is there that the Lord makes his home on earth, and there alone would they catch a glimpse of him. In Psalm 63, David says that he had seen the Lord in his sanctuary and there beheld his power and glory. After the victory of the great king, what more appropriate place to go than to the presence of the one who has delivered them, there to declare his praise, there to declare his salvation, there to declare their thanks for what he has done. His covenant loyalty is what they declare. His faithful, unfailing love has been shown in warding off the enemy of the people, warding off his own enemies. His name, his presence fills the earth. So now too, his praise. Did not Rahab and Jericho tremble on account of what they'd heard of the great and mighty things that God had done? The Gibeonites deceived the Israelites because they too had heard. The nations tremble. God's right hand is that picture of the saving power that brought the people up out of Egypt. And here, a reminder that it's that same hand that brought them up out of Egypt is that hand which keeps Jerusalem, keeps Zion in her hour of need. And it's a righteousness. It's a judgment. It's a judgment against God's enemies. That which is blessing to Zion is a judgment upon his enemies. Zion and Judah rejoice while God's enemies flee in terror. God has made his city impregnable. He has made it his home. He is the great king, mighty in power to act and to save, a strong tower into which his people have run for refuge. God has made her secure, and so now the faithful are told, verses 12, 13, walk about Zion. Go around her, count her towers. Consider well her ramparts, view her citadels, in order that you might tell of them to the next generation. The message to the next generation, what is it? The architecture of a city, of his city. What significance this architecture? Why talk about these buildings, this fortress? At the heart of the message of the Old Testament found in the book of Deuteronomy is a challenge to communicate from one generation to the next, not merely the commands and laws of the Lord, but those great and mighty things that God has done, the miracles, the wonders he did in taking for himself a people out from among another people and delivering Israel from Egypt. To take what the one generation had seen of God's mighty deliverance and tell the next. Moses tells the people not to let slip from their hearts the great and mighty things God has done. And what are we to tell? Or what is the Israelite living in Zion to tell the next generation? He's to proclaim the architecture of the city, to tell others that it still stands. And it isn't indeed as lofty or great as other mountains. And the city was not necessarily more well fortified to look at. But something about looking at it still standing in the face of onslaught, that God, against all odds, had defended her. He'd loved his people, had shown himself to be their God, indeed is what they declare. The psalmist and the people have seen a great salvation. The nation saw something that terrified them. Now the people of Zion are called to look. It's God's presence that asks them to look. He has made Zion lofty, secure, and in the end proclaims this in verse 14, "For this God is our God forever and ever. Understand that He has made her secure. He will be our guide even to the end." The message of that city, that its architecture, its walls proclaim, is that this is God's dwelling place. God keeps her secure through all trials. He's central to the gospel. The city of Jerusalem, of Zion, holds a central place to the gospel preached to the next generation. See the city of God. See her beauty. See that she survives. See what God has done on her behalf. See that He dwells there. It is our God that has done this. He is working in us to lead and deliver us. But we have a small problem when it comes to our application of this psalm for us. That city of which the sons of Korah spoke was destroyed, went up in smoke on more than one occasion. It's a subject of another chapel talk, the whys and wherefores of all that. The glory of the Lord departed from the temple. Ezekiel saw it, saw God's presence lift and linger and lift and move again and depart. How do we encourage one another with this psalm today? For this city, this one that seemed impregnable, this fortress, how are we to proclaim its walls yet to another generation? Having walked the walls of modern-day Jerusalem myself, I often have wondered what connection these Turkish walls, built only a few hundred years ago, have to the walls of that splendor of that city 2,600 years ago. Where does God dwell today? Where is His temple? Where does God live? What is the living evidence of the message of Psalm 48 that God is exalted today? I'm looking at it. I'm looking at the church, a representative group from among that church. This is where God is present today. This is the place of which Jesus is the sure foundation, the temple now that He has built and chosen to inhabit. And I don't mean this by Westminster. I mean this church of which Westminster is a servant of Christ, a servant of the church. But somehow we're afraid to take this tour around the church, to look at her ramparts, to walk on her walls, for fear of what we might see, fear that we might see disharmony, infighting, denominationalism, false doctrine, disagreement. The church. You say you could never walk around the church and tell your children about it. It's so imperfect. Why, look at Brother Smith over there. I'm not meaning Winston here, by the way. When I wrote this, I did not know he would be sitting there. And then there's Brother Jones. We know their weaknesses. We don't dare bring the unbeliever in to see such. And yet Jesus tells us, in the context of expressing the full extent of His love, in His great prophetic prayer found in John 13 to 17, particularly John 17, that we are to love one another as He loved us, that we are to lay down our lives for one another, and that it's that quality, that loving one another, that will be a testimony to the world. Not merely that we have the Word of God, but the Spirit works in us in such a way that we have the love of Jesus for one another, that will be a testimony to the nations, to the world, that Jesus is the Lord, that God is presence among us. When was the last time you invited someone to come and see the church, to walk around the walls, to see this place, to say, "See that brother over there, see that sister there," as they worship I know something about the power of the gospel that has changed that person. Let me tell you about it. Let them tell you about it. Think of your children, inviting them to see and hear the great and mighty things God has done in the generation that has gone ahead of them. And I see God at work there. I want to believe, and sometimes I'm faithless, but I want to believe that God is preparing a bride, and it is without spot or wrinkle. It's not just in purity of doctrine, but it's in purity of love one for another. Yes, it seems strange to us to think of the church as part of the gospel message. I'm not saying the church is perfect, or that we're bringing people to see our holiness. Rather, come see love that has changed people, the love of God, that makes it possible for selfish human beings to esteem others better than themselves, to lay down their lives for one another. This points to Jesus and Jesus alone. The psalmist saw the great and mighty things that God did. The psalmist saw that God was present there. We too need to see that God is present in the church and that it makes a difference, that we are secure, built on a sure foundation, and we're secure to love one another. We're secure to pursue pure and holy doctrine. And now, when the nations look, invite them into the city. Don't close the door, but let the nations stream in. Let them see the testimony. There's a reversal. They are to look now with us. And that finally is the call to look, to see the great and mighty things God has done. Yes, in the past, but presently in the church that He defends, that He keeps, of which you and I are a part. And we need not go up on the Holy Mount. We stand on the Holy Mount. We are the temple of God. We are close, and we can declare there His praises. And let's join together now as we declare the praises of God in prayer for what He has done on behalf of His church.